Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carell. We're joined today by Frankie Arvello. He's an outside counsel providing services to the tech startup community, as well as general partner at Rising Tide Venture Partners, focusing on underrepresented founders in tech. In addition to building a company and finding product market fit, there are a ton of different legal risks founders will face along their startup's journey. Company formation, raising equity, hiring employees, structuring contracts, and maybe even an exit. Rather than trying to go it alone, Frankie outlines the many benefits of working with outside counsel from the very beginning. Not only will this protect you, but also well-meaning angel investors, like Uncle Joe. Also, you won't want to miss the things founders aren't thinking about today, but absolutely should be. And now, on to the show. All right, Frankie Arvello, thank you for joining the Insurance Podcast today.
Well, great being here.
Awesome. And for the listeners out there, would you mind introducing yourself and kind of a little bit about your background?
Sure. I'll try to keep it brief, although us attorneys tend to get really long-winded, probably because we get paid by the hour. Frankie Arvello, based in Austin, Texas. Most importantly, I'm a husband and a father to two children who are 1 and 3. So pandemic life and working at home is really interesting. So if you hear any yelling in the background, that's probably my one-year-old. Originally from New York, big, gigantic Knicks fan, so I'm just, and Mets fan, so I love suffering, if you will. So maybe it fits my personality and the profession I chose. So I've been practicing law since 2010. Came to Austin to get an MBUT, decided to stick around, and we can get into that story a bit more after being exposed to the startup scene. And I've been a startup attorney since about 2013, first freelancing on my own, eventually joining a firm in town that's a pretty well-known boutique, Egan Nelson. Good firm, good people, love them forever. I decided to leave there in about 2018 to work as a partner, another firm called Richard Rodriguez Skeef. And then about a little over a year ago, I was like, well, maybe I got the entrepreneur bug myself and decided to go off and run my own firm, which I've been doing since then. The practice revolves around everything from formation to issuing your equity to your founders to your first seed financing. Right now, I'm actually working a Series Seed for a client that needs to hit payroll. That's a lot of my work, a lot of financing work from angels as well as VCs in town. And it goes all the way through the gamut. So then there's commercial agreements, which there's an insurance such as that, of course, all the way through to exit when everyone's happy, hopefully, if things go well and everyone's sad. And yeah, so that's a brief background myself. Also, for folks in Austin, I am general counsel to Beam, which is an angel network that supports female founders. And I'm a part of Women at Austin as an advisory council member, again, supporting women founders, as well as a mentor to DivInc, which supports underrepresented founders, and am a friend of Techstars and get involved with Capital Factory here and there. So.
Right on. So tell me about your kind of inspiration. What inspired you to work with startups?
So I guess there's two things here, right? There's the why startups and then why underrepresented founders. So I'll start with the why startups. So when I moved to Austin, the reason I was gonna get my MBA was I thought I was leaving the law. I was like, I'm gonna go to UT, become an oil and gas consultant, and then quickly realized that I thought it was even more boring than law was. But then during the summer, between my first and second year of MBA, I worked for a startup that no longer exists. It was called Mass Relevance, which was acquired by Spreadfast, which became part of Lithium. And I love the energy and the people there. Everyone was all hands on deck. Let's get this product out there. And for folks who are maybe unfamiliar with what Mass Relevance was, they essentially helped visualize Twitter. So have you ever seen Twitter heat maps, or if you go, you watch television, you see Twitter scrolls, like that was them. They built that, right? And they're trying to show the ROI and they're selling it to brands, advertising agencies, et cetera. But what drew me was the energy of the folks there. And I really was like, wow, this is a lot different. I worked at Goldman before. This is a lot different than Goldman, where everyone's like really buttoned up and I have my little view of the world. At Mass Relevance, we had our CFO, Kevin Dash, at the time. He and I would prepare for a board meeting in the morning to show the sales reports from the last quarter. In the afternoon, we put up a whiteboard throughout the office, because it's no one's above anything. Everyone has to get the work done. So the energy was great. I then became a TA for what still exists. It's called Longhorn Startup Lab. at the University of Texas. It's run by Bob Metcalf, who created the Ethernet, and Josh Baer, who everyone in Austin knows. And if you don't, I don't know how you don't know him. And then through them, I became even more involved in the startup scene. And then I worked quickly for a hot second with Cisco, but I just love the energy and the passion for people working at SERPs, or like the problems they're trying to solve. I was like, you know, I think I can help them as legal counsel. And I was freelancing doing it before. And I was like, let me go help them out. So the reason, so that's why I started. So I was like, I just love the energy. I love giving counsel to people who really are looking for help and need help, unlike gigantic Fortune 500 companies. The reason why underrepresented founders stick out to me is just, you know, there's a ton of literature out there about just the gap between things like women founders. I think the number is 7% receive VC money, and then Black and Latinx founders, it's like 2% or something absurd. Being a brown man myself, it's something I experienced growing up. Don't need to regale you with all the stories, but I was dealt with prejudice and assumptions as well. So it's something that is core to me. And I was like, well, let's see how I can help folks out. So I decided to become involved with Women at Austin and Div Inc. because through Notley, they're looking to really impact in a positive way the achievement, not the achievement gap, but the wealth creation gap, if you will, and then help entrepreneurs in those spaces.
Tell me a little bit more about how you affect those organizations through legal counsel.
Through what I do is I'm a mentor for Div Inc. And then I also just talk to Preston and Monica, who are, you know, some of the leads there, and I give advice and counsel on things I've seen. One of the key values I think attorneys have is that we see so many deals, so many people, so many companies that we're able to connect people and just connect ideas. Granted, yes, we're not a founder. We don't know what it's like to actually go in there and build things. We have learned experience that we can share. And then so I share that with them. And then with Women at Austin, I have taken a more formal role where, so long as it isn't one of my clients, because then there's a conflict, I need to stay out of it. I help advise them on sort of the negotiations they need to have. And it's going to be upcoming because they're closing their first round of funding with portfolio companies, and you know, what's the best return for their investors for Women at Austin and those SPVs, and how do we align that with what the startup wants as well. So then my job is sort of from a legal perspective, mostly align sort of interests to make sure that everything's papered correctly. So, you know, the Women at Austin investors can succeed and the startup companies can succeed as well.
Working with startup founders, especially in the early rounds, what are some commonly held beliefs that you see pop up that you try, not necessarily to change, but maybe to provide more education on?
One is that they believe that a lot of our work can just be templated and you could just do it yourself. Something like a certificate of organization, yeah, or incorporation, yeah, that can be templated. That can be done. But the real value of an attorney is helping you think through, and what's the next step, right? How are we splitting up our equity? Should we have vesting or not? What happens if you don't? The attorney has, such as myself, I've seen that, you know, if you don't, let's say, for instance, you decide you don't want to have vesting. I've seen instances where someone has a major life event. Maybe a spouse becomes disabled. They don't have insurance. They now need to go out and get a full-time job. Well, if there's no vesting mechanism, that person hangs on to their stock. You may have someone that's doing a ton of the work and another person sort of, for lack of a better term in my mind, free riding, right? And that creates a lot of disconnect, a lot of negative emotions, and that startup may fail for that reason. But if you haven't seen that before, you haven't thought of that, and you're only thinking as a founder, you're generally going to be really positive and otherwise you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. You think you're going to change the world, of course, like I love that energy, but you need someone to sometimes think of what happens in case things don't go well. Right. So a lot of founders don't think about that and they don't think of the terms. They think that the lawyers just said to slow things down. And that's another piece, is that oftentimes founders want to move fast. And sometimes when you move fast, you break things, which sometimes isn't a bad idea, right? When you're iterating on a product, fine. But when you're doing something like working on your first financing, that it can be a hard bust. So what do I mean by that? How can it go sideways? Let's say, for instance, you are really excited. You want some cash, you have an uncle that's an unaccredited investor, and we can get into that a bit more. He wants to give you invest $25,000 for 0.1% of your company. Awesome, I have a now $25 million valuation on my company. this is amazing. I don't need a lawyer, or just I'll put it together in an email and then he'll just send me the cash. What happens there? And you just want the money because you just want it done. You don't want a lawyer to paper and it takes 2 weeks. Maybe you're worried about your uncle like getting concerned, having cold feet. So what happens in that instance, especially really early, is that that valuation's really off. Your uncle's likely to be underwater in the next investment. So you got to think about that. Two, if you have an unaccredited investor, that creates all the breaks down the line, because essentially, not to bore you with all the details of the SEC, but essentially that person, unless you take all the, like, you have something like audited financials, you send them every quarter and other items like that, they can always say, hey, I don't know what I invested in. I want my money back. I'm suing the company. You defrauded me. It becomes a gigantic headache. And because of that reason, if you ever looked at for venture money, they're going to just say, no, get rid of that person.
So is that something that you would advise against, or not maybe advise against, but educate on the difference between an unaccredited investor as well as an accredited investor?
Yeah, absolutely. So in that instance, I would advise the company, let's say they really wanted the person to come in, I'd advise the company structure as a loan, because that's not a security. And if the person wanted some sort of equity in the company, I was like, well, bring them on as a consultant, make sure they actually do some real work for the company. That's a workaround. Generally, I don't advise unaccredited investors to come on board. There are certain ways around that, where if you have something like a Form C filing through WeFunder or Republic, but then there's other paperwork that goes with that as well, which allows you to do that. So when the founder moves too fast, they don't think they need a lawyer. That's when I see them get into issues. And what happens there, just going back a bit, is that you try to solve or do something quickly, and you end up costing yourself a lot of money and legal fees and headaches down the line. So oftentimes I tell folks to engage with an attorney when you're either raising money, when you're about to enter into a contract with someone else, when you want to issue equity between the founders, engage with an attorney. If you just want to form a company, open a bank account, you don't really need us. Right? From what attorneys assume about startups is that you either need to work with a unicorn or just don't care. What I found is that, especially bigger law firms, big law firms are like big companies, right? They want gigantic contracts, gigantic deals. They're paying their partners $1,000 an hour, and their mid-level associates are billing $500 an hour. And they have like, I want to make $5-7 million as a partner. And so we need the revenue coming in, right? So we need those gigantic hits. What you miss, especially here at Austin, you miss a lot of those eight-figure, low nine-figure valued companies that will still give you a good amount of work and still need the help, right? Which, you know, luckily for me, it actually opens a market opportunity because of the big, you know, I'm not going to name law firms, but the bigger law firms will just ignore those companies, or they'll offer them some deal. And this goes to my second point, where they'll say, we'll defer $25,000 of fees. They assume a founder is not going to think through that, where a founder will be like, well, defer doesn't mean you're going to forgive. Right. So you're still going to charge me. That guy's going to charge me $800 an hour, and I'm still going to have to pay this. So you're deferring, not forgiving. So another assumption that attorneys make about founders is that founders don't do their homework. The really good founders do, right? Before even engaging with me, they'll read my blog or they'll read general items, because I think, thankfully, like at least for very basic things that happen over and over again, there's a lot of information out there where you can find like what's a convertible note, like what's a common equity split. You can just Google this stuff, right? You can find some good articles. So founders do their homework. I think attorneys assume that they don't, and that they're just lost in the fog. And the last thing I think attorneys need to work on is, and again, this creates a market opportunity for me, is being more open with their fees and how much they think things will cost. Attorneys don't do that generally, from my perspective, because I think when you have, you know, a partner, a mid-level associate, a junior level associate, and a paralegal all working on a matter, and everyone reviews everyone else's work, they kind of don't know how much it's gonna cost. People oftentimes say, well, the solo attorney, you know, they're gonna cost more because they're gonna charge you more per hour than my junior level attorney does. It's like, well, you also review the junior level attorney's work, because generally, they don't know what they're doing in the beginning. And then it goes back to the mid-level person or senior person. So there's rounds of review. Whereas for me, I'm like, I can just tell someone straight up, I think it's going to cost XYZ because I'm doing the work. Or I might have my other employee do a little bit of work as well. But I'll have a general sense as to how much it costs. So I think bigger law firms generally are not understanding that startups need a better understanding as to how much things will cost, because they need to be able to budget for it. And that's a missed opportunity on their end, and I'm happy to take advantage of that.
In the budget process, what are those talks like? You offer a very transparent model, and in helping them budget for that, how does that usually work for maybe a startup that is devoting most, or if not all, of their capital to employee expense, product building, et cetera? How do they make room for legal counsel that they would absolutely need?
So that the last part is the most important part. What do they absolutely need? So what we'll do is we'll have a consultation initially, and then moving on down the line. And then I'll just ask, a good way to figure out if an attorney is actually a good attorney for your company is to see if they ask questions, right, about the business and what you actually need. If the attorney says, sure, whatever, I'll do it. You know, they're one, not interested, and maybe they don't know what you're doing. So then maybe, are they giving the best advice? So let's say, for instance, a client comes to me and says, you know, I have these employees I brought on board. They're really excited about getting options. Let's say there's 10 employees about to get them. How can we get this done? Right. So they'll ask questions like, well, you know, do you have something like Carta that can get a lot of this done more quickly? Do you understand that, like, the vesting schedules for everyone? So I'll help them like go through sort of the thought process. So we have fewer iterations. And I'll say, all right, given all that you told me and that I understand about the company, it'll cost X, right? And then I'll say, well, can you afford it? And if they say, you know, no, not right now, then I'll normally ask the question is it mission critical? Sometimes they say no, sometimes they say yes. I'm like, well, if you have these employees who are really excited, you need to, like, my role is to help the company succeed. You know, I'm happy to defer fees for a month or two, or can we work on a payment plan? That's what I do, generally, right? Now, if it's something they don't need, if it's not mission critical, or if they have a terms of use that's good enough, but it needs a scrub, I'll say, well, you know, understanding that, maybe we can defer this for a month or two and then see how your budget looks. Now that I've given you a number, maybe you could figure it out, right? And carve out some cash for me. I totally understand that I'm not, generally my work isn't gonna like, it can break the company if I do it bad. It's not gonna save the company. It's not gonna, mostly it is, sometimes it creates value, but it's not as much as an engineer, of course, right? Or a marketing person, a salesperson. So when it comes on like the totem pole, I come lower, and that's fine.
Being in the insurance industry, I always kind of equate that to like the cup holder in the car. The cup holder is not going to make or break, but if it's done wrong, you notice it. Switching gears, what are some things that you wish tech startups would do more of?
So, I have a lot of thoughts here. I'm just thinking of my naughty clients. You should engage, again, this comes back to sort of being penny wise, pound foolish. You should engage your attorney. Again, they should be a partner to the business, not just a mercenary that works on a document, sends it away, and they go away. You should engage them pretty early when you're thinking of any sort of key commercial agreement. What happens is if you don't, you'll negotiate on your own with the counterparty, some sort of agreement, then you want to get it done. You bring the attorney in at the 11th hour, and then the attorney feels rushed, right? They may still say, let's slow things down. They may also not have time to ask questions about other things going on. So what you do is you end up having a deal that isn't as good for the company.
So and you also do you think they engage you so late in the process? Is it, do you find that it's purposeful, or are they focused more on just the nuts and bolts of the agreement?
I think, that's a great question. I should read their minds. The reason, because some folks don't do that. Some folks are better about it. The reason I think some clients do that is I think they just want to get it done quickly, and they feel like, I'm going to slow it down. Or attorneys will slow it down. Whereas, you know, they should think of, again, doing it right and getting someone involved early, so we're not at the 11th hour slowing it down. Because I would, that also, you know, if I come in and I say, hey, let's look at this, let's wait a week, we need to have some back and forth for the other side. You know, that annoys the other side as well. If they think they're done and they're not done, then that does it. So I really think it's because sometimes folks are like, you know, the lawyers are just going to, you know, look at the key indemnification terms and that's it, right? And if your lawyer is really good, they're going to look at more than that. I've actually counseled clients on not doing that because I'm like, you see this pain I saved you, because sometimes I save them pain. I'm like, this is the pain you would have felt if you didn't slow, you just rushed through it, right? Like, I saved you probably a ton of money because you didn't think through this all. So I think that's the reason why they just want to get it done. And it's not because they don't value legal services. I think it's more, again, it becomes a rush deal. Like, I just want to rush, get through it, get it knocked out. And yeah, all right, Frankie, just sign off. And I'm like, well, I'm company counsel. I just don't sign off on things. I have to make sure I'm doing my job. Right. That I can get in trouble. And also because I actually do care about your company.
Yeah. And so what are some of those pain that you've experienced when it might not have been done thoughtfully? What are some of those things that
yeah, arise? I'll give you an example. So what's coming up lately, and we can, this might be a good segue into, if you want, into financing, and is a lot of finders are out there. And by the way, there are SEC rules that are being proposed to allow for finders to operate as quasi brokers. So brokers generally get a percentage of the deal. And normally you have to be registered through the SEC, and that's a giant expensive process. And a lot of people out there who are quote unquote consultants or finders, right, who are kind of quasi operating as broker dealers. So one of my recent clients was engaging someone who was a finder and wanted a percentage of a deal. I was
so like, are these finders for?
Sorry, like, finders for capital. So okay, I'm gonna go help you raise your money, right?
And, okay. And
since nowadays, I think folks are a little stressed in fundraising, at least for early stages, and as companies I haven't been invested in before, isn't as easy as it used to be. It's actually been pretty hard for a lot of clients. Those finders are looking more attractive, even though they take 10% of whatever they find, right? Which is a giant figure. So some things I've seen is folks not checking to see if this person's a broker. These people are broker dealers, right? They also don't think about the payment terms. So let's say I will take 10% of all fundraising going forward. It's like, well, my counter to that would be, what if you had nothing to do with bringing in the money? Should you be collecting that 10%? No, it might be, right? Maybe you get some deducted fee for that, but you didn't bring in the cash, you didn't close the deal. I want to incentivize you to go out there and get the money for the client, and not just, I signed this contract, I helped you with your deck, now I get 10% of perpetuity, I'm going to sit on the sideline. These are things sometimes clients don't think through, because they're like, all right, you're going to help me raise the money, I need the money, let's get it done. And then my job is to come and say, whoa. Do these terms align with how we want people to engage to help your company grow? And if there are things that are missing, then I'm going to point it out. Or, you know, are we going to break some SEC rules with broker dealer where, you know, we're gonna have to give back the money and pay a penalty and go through a gigantic hack, like just nasty process? That's a concern as well. I'm going to flag it. So those are the sorts of things I see. That's why you have a lawyer, right? At least they let me know. At least they didn't sign it. That's the one thing is that the worst is when they sign it, like, hey, this is fine, right? I'm like, oh, but yeah, that's, that is sort of, those are the sorts of things I think when you engage with counsel, especially if you do it a little earlier, you can make sure you can protect yourself against as a company.
Great. Yeah. So you touched on financing, especially that it's harder to find fundraising opportunities, especially if you've never been invested in before. Tell me about how things have changed currently during the pandemic. What are some of those changes that founders out there should be aware of?
So definitely valuations have dropped from my data of just talking to people and deals I've seen. So maybe you used to, and again, a lot of, especially angel investing, is more art than science. I had a client that had a revenue valuation model. I'm like, hey, you did a lot more effort and think of your valuation than anyone ever does in this community. Most folks just go finger to sky, pick a number. But let's say a valuation used to be 5 or 4, 4.5. That's dropped like a million. I've seen a lot of that. So that's been depressed. And the reason for that is, especially with a lot of the smaller funds and angel investors, is that they're worried about their own companies. Either their own companies they're operating, or companies that they've already invested in where they've already vetted. And COVID has just, you know, thrown up, just, it's just made everything just insane. And people can't predict the future, which any business person will tell you is the worst thing. Even if it's going to be bad, at least I can predict what it's going to look like, so I can model for it. But if I don't know what's going on, I'm going to be really nervous. I'm going to hold my cash and spend cash in things I know. So what that's done is it's depressed values. There also is a lot more downside protection. I just had a deal come across my desk where there is a 2x liquidation preference minimum. And for those who are unfamiliar, what that means is if I'm a new investor and I put in $1 million in your company, I'm getting preferred stock, right? It means I get paid before the common stock gets paid out, right, as preferred. That's one of the rights you get. And normally you see 1x liquidation preference, or you convert it to common. So normally you would get $1 million. With the 2X, that company will have to get 2 million. The investor will have to get 2 million before any of the common shareholders get any cash. So that's a lot different than what I've seen. So that's downside protection, because folks are thinking, well, maybe you won't have an exit company as great as we thought it would be. We want to make sure we can at least get back more than at least 2X our capital before we pay you out. And that is a term that investors are that's things I'm starting to see. So more about downside protection for investors, lower valuations. And then there's just a lot of, and this is something, I'd advise companies to, and we can get into this a lot more, to think about how to, instead of chasing cash from investors who are unwilling to invest, spend some time on that, but also think about how you can negotiate your payment terms with your vendors, how you can accelerate, just think of AR, AP, accounts receivable, accounts payable, sort of financing. How can you get cash back from your customers a bit more? I'm dealing with, there's this vendor that I deal with for filing company documents, right? With the Delaware or Texas, whomever. Historically, they've been like, yeah, pay us when you want to pay us, right? Now they're like, pay us before we do the work. So I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I used to be able to wait on this $800,000 and now you want it now. Okay. So I've seen people doing things like that, which I think is smart. Like if you can get your payment up front as a company and pay your vendors a little later, that's a good way to sort of lengthen your runway. So think about, I guess, in the broader sense, as I think about other ways to help finance your company beyond just chasing money. If you can, sometimes you just need it. And we can get into alternative financing a bit more, but yeah, I've seen too many companies try to chase angels and micro funds too early. And those funds don't have the cash and waste a lot of time and a lot of energy that they could spend elsewhere.
So when's a good time to go after an angel round, a seed round? What are some milestones that you generally recommend that are hit to have that solid foundation in place?
So it used to be like you could go in with and I actually watched like a very old video from the Foundry Group that talked about, this was in 2007, it was Jason Emelson. It was like, yeah, you have your deck and your idea and you get funded. I'm like, whoa, that was how it used to be, right? That is not how it worked. I think of the sort of like, and Gordon Doherty of the Capital Factory made this point as well. Like you need some key inflection points. So I'll tell you what I think some of those are. And I'm sure VCs and other folks will have differing opinions, but sure. At least have a minimum viable product before you go raise for money that isn't friends and family. Have something you can show people that actually works, right? And it's even better if you want to go to proper sort of, I think of groups like Beam. I'm not part of the investment team there. Actually don't know exactly their criteria. They can share that with you, but I imagine Beam wants to see something like some revenue or some users, at the very least, to show that you have some sort of traction. For an early investor group, the number will depend on what's good, depends on your sort of industry, your vertical, what your focus is on. So I can't just give, it just depends on your circumstance. If you want to go after Silverton or some of these bigger funds for more of a first proper larger equity financing, the rule of thumb has been, and we'll see if it changes, is 100,000 MRR, and at least have it for 3 months.
You and can that's talk monthly, to them, monthly recurring revenue.
Okay. Yeah, monthly recurring revenue. So what that means is not one-off projects, like because this is why a lot of models switch. Like Microsoft, right? They used to charge you for your license. Here, pay us $300. Now here's your license. Now they understood a better way for them to be valued is they have this lifetime cash flow coming in. So now you get charged like $20 a month or something like that. I forget what it is. So make sure you have that locked in before you go. You can have conversations with them beforehand. And I actually do advise that. They want to know who you are before you just show up the check or ask you for a check. So put them on your list, have a conversation. Wait till you're ready before you go out and actually properly ask for cash. So that those are sort of some of the metrics I see. And understand that when you are raising, the process, especially if you go through a proper VC, it's short of angels. If you go a proper VC, the process to close a round has been estimated to be about 6 months. So build that into your model when you're figuring out your fume date, right? And then also give yourself a little bit of like leeway. So you're not raising from VC as you're running out of money, because they'll one way or another find out. And what they can do then is hammer you on terms.
They know you need it, so they kind of got the leverage.
Yeah, they got the leverage. They know you're going to want to close. You're going to say, hey, Frankie, you know, we don't have time. Close it. And I'm like, all right, well, I got to keep the company alive. Sure. Whereas if you give yourself like a few months to negotiate, then, and especially if you have a competing term sheet, then you'll have an opportunity to negotiate better terms for yourself.
Awesome. So switching gears, a lot of conversations that I've had with founders recently has kind of centered on how important contracts are in their business, especially for the monthly recurring revenue, signing new logos on. We had touched on it, some of the things where first and foremost, right, have your legal counsel involved from the beginning to help you out. What are some of the ways that you help, especially from the contractual language perspective?
So best case scenario, use our form, right? Use our form as a prepared, and sometimes I can't be that you can't because you're going to work with a Google or a gigantic company. And then even in those instances, I say, try to negotiate. And if they say no, at least understand where you can be hurt and understand as a founder. So that's a key point. Sometimes they're like, no, we're not going to change our terms. You're going to take them. So best case scenario, use our term, ensure that the payment terms are favorable to the company. Meaning, you know, what is market? Let's say it's net 60. Well, can we make it net 45? Like, can you do something like that? Right. From a contractual perspective. Also, and it depends on the company, I'm going to give you that lawyer answer, but one of my clients has a hardware product that can cause damage to someone if used improperly. So what protections have we put in there? So then you have things like, you know, you will covenants that the user, the customer has that says, you will use this properly. You will not allow children to be around this device. You will carry insurance of your own to protect against any bodily injury here. You will let us know if the device becomes defective. You will not try to change the device or do it. So you have things like that are very fact specific, right? If you're a software company, no, you're not going to have that because you don't need that, right? But if you're a hardware company, you care about that. And then you have to care about things like if you are, again, company specific, let's say you are a marketplace that connects users or vendors to people who are customers buying in. You have to lay out in your terms of use sort of how that process works. If there's a dispute between the customer and the vendor that you're not part of it or that they're going to settle. So you lay out how it works so they don't come after you, right? And then, of course, you have things like limiting liability to the value of the contract. So you're not opening yourself to full liability for anything that happens. You also have indemnification clauses, which are pretty common. Best case scenario for me, it's like we protect the company against negligence. Most people say, no, it has to be at least gross negligence, which is just a different standard from a legal perspective. And that protects you as a company from someone basically screwing up. Let's say it's a vendor you're using, screwing up and then causing harm to your client, your end client. And then the end client comes after you. You can then go to your vendor and say, well, you messed up because your servers went down or whatever it is, right? You're going to have to pay. I'm out of this. This isn't my fault. But you have to make sure that's in your agreement with them. So best case scenario, use our forms. The terms will be mostly pro company. If there's a lot of pushback, not just one counterparty, but let's say there's pushback from a ton of counterparties, my job is then to sort of tone it down. If I see that there's that, generally I have a good sense of what's market, but let's say I'm wrong or the market's changing, to tone it down to make it a little bit more equitable. And because at the end of the day, legal should not, as long as we're not leaving the company entirely or just way too unprotected, we should not be stopping deals.
Like the business prevention unit, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is something I learned. I was a compliance officer at Goldman. This is something I learned at Goldman. They're like, well, you know, we still got to operate a business. Like you can say, we don't want to do it this way, but help me figure out to get the economics I need. Right? Or we can't protect ourselves 100%, but like, let me know. So yeah. An attorney's job isn't, unless it's absolutely, you're going to kill the company or do something horrible, our job shouldn't be to stop deals. Our job should be to enable the company to go through with deals, but to protect itself in doing so as much as it can.
Yeah. And, you know, there are other ways of protecting the company outside of the contract, right? That the contract is generally the first line of defense, you know, in a dispute, but you've still got other levers of risk control, right? That you can implement just, you know, say, okay, well, if the contract maybe isn't going to protect me in the best way here, what can I do in my business processes, in my quality control to make sure that, you know, even though maybe I'm not protected in the contract, I can still work on protecting myself from that maybe arising or mitigating some of the severity of a situation like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Quick question on some provisions and contracts that don't get a lot of press or talk before the pandemic, but I hear more and more talk about force majeure clauses. How how important are those now, and the ones who did negotiate those properly?
Yeah, force majeure, everyone's like, yeah, whatever. And even I was like, oh, I should start flipping in pandemic into my force majeure, which you don't have. It's like God, war, or government action is actually where people are like, well, can I actually, this is what actually people are focused on, right? And there's going to be some litigation from this. And I'm interested to see how this will all pan out, where you have a government action, let's say in Austin, you have the government that said you basically cannot have South by Southwest, right? How does that allow South by Southwest to then not pay its due, like what it owes its own vendors? Is that enough? The government says you cannot have events that are of X size and X space. I'm not sure. The courts will let us know, but that's something where, you know, people are actually looking at those clauses. I've stuck in pandemic. It's generally sort of a catch-all provision, which from a legal perspective isn't as strong as having something that says specifically, if this happens, we don't have to pay you. Like if X, like let's say if there is a pandemic, we don't have to pay you. If it's really broad, as most force majeure clauses are written, they're typically not as strong from a legal reading perspective. But again, I'm going to be interested to see how the courts decide on, you know, is something saying akin to government action, closing on something like a South by Southwest, enough to protect someone to get out of that contract?
Yeah. It's going to be interesting how that plays out because, yeah, I mean, it's interesting how many different facets of life and business and commerce that the pandemic has touched. And, you know, it's just, it's another one to add on there and see how the courts decide. Frankie, before you go, I wanted to learn a little bit more about your work at Beam Angel Network. What is the vision for Beam Angel Network?
So the whole reason this exists, so Women at Austin is sort of the parent to Beam, right? And the purpose of Women at Austin is, again, to help women entrepreneurs. And that isn't just emerging growth companies, it's everything, right? Help women and entrepreneurs succeed in their businesses, whether that be through some funding, which is Beam, or through mentorship, through connections and all that. So with that process, Women Austin did a survey of women entrepreneurs and they asked, you know, what are some of the biggest issues that you've experienced? Number one, but not a surprise to anyone, right? But you still have to do the homework and ask, was fundraising. So as a group, we went back as the advisory council run through Jess and her team there. We looked at it, we're like, well, how do we address this? And thankfully, as a group, we have some women who are pretty, and some men, obviously I'm a part of the group as well, who are really well accomplished, who've done well, and can actually write checks and support these women founders. So we said, well, let's go back. How can we support them? We're like, well, we just from an investment thesis, I don't think we can support a smaller sort of shop or smaller service or anything like that. But what we can support are emerging growth companies, just from the investment thesis strategy, right? That's just how it works on our end. Because, you know, I'm not going to walk through the VC map, but it's essentially that. Like, some are going to be big hits. Most will give you just your money back, and some will just not make it. So we need to support women entrepreneurs in Texas, although I don't know if that'll change or not. Maybe it'll get larger than that. But for now, we've been focused on Texas. So we need to create a pipeline of companies to look at, then connect them with these amazing investors to give them capital, but more than just capital, advice and guidance on a more one-to-one basis rather than just workshops. So we're going through that process now. I believe we reviewed like over 100 applicants, 100 companies. We don't have a set number of companies we're going to invest in. It's going to essentially be, do you hit the criteria? If you hit the criteria, we're going to then bring it to a group, investment team, say, hey, who wants to invest? There's a giant group of angels underneath. We're going to look at that and say, I'm in. And then that's when my work comes in, is to like make sure it's all papered right and to get that done. And our hope is that, no, and I didn't talk about this, but I think there's a pretty big funding gap in just this sort of ecosystem where folks will get money to start their company from friends and family, but then it's really hard to get seed right now for whatever reason. It's just, and I think I should be going through some of it pandemic related, to get some seed financing to then get you to the Silverton level where you actually have a proper Series A. Our goal is to help with seed a bit, and especially obviously women entrepreneurs, and set to help fund them. So yeah, we're going to work with good companies that, you know, are going to be hopefully rocket ships going up in the sky, maybe some unicorns in there, and help them get invested. And my job is going to be, at least from a women and us perspective, to make sure we get them settled. I can't give counsel to those companies, but you know, to help them in other ways as well.
Awesome. No, that's incredible. I'm glad to see the Beam Angel Network really start to take off, and interested in following the journey, and wish everyone well. Frankie, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. Very interesting. Where can people go to learn more about your work?
Great. Yes. Plug time. I have a pretty active blog, and there's something actually, it's the Underrepresented Founders Report. For 2020, I need to plug that for my employee, Rena, who's a student at UC Berkeley, who actually just got a job offer at Bain. I'm happy for her, but I'm also like, no, I'm going to lose you.
Bittersweet.
Bittersweet, but she was amazing. She put together a report where she interviewed a bunch of founders, mostly in the Austin area, from who are women, Black, Latinx, LGBTQ, et cetera, and sort of got their sort of feelings about how it's been for them, and also how they've succeeded. And to share that information. So check out my website, which I'll tell you now, it has that. The website is atxstartupattorney.com. Ton of stuff there, some videos, lots of blogs I've written, lists of resources that you can use, great stuff on there. If you want to find me, Frank Iravillo, LinkedIn, I put some stuff out there as well. And I have a law firm site. It's not as nice as the blog site, but it's Arvillo PLLC. That was more of a Wix creation by me. You could see the lack of talent I had. This is what happens when a lawyer tries to design something. But that's another way to check me out as well.
Awesome. Well, that's great. Yeah. Thanks again, Frankie, for coming on the show, and have a good one.
Awesome. Take care.
That does it for this episode of Beyond the Policy. If you've missed prior episodes and want to catch up, please visit us at howyouinsurethat.com. Again, that's howyouinsurethat.com. And to never miss an episode in the future, please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you download and listen to shows. Until next time, thanks for joining us, and stay risky.